नायदेशिकायस्य वश्ये जनोऽयम्। श्रीराजोवाच निशाम्यदेव स्वपथोपवर्णितम् प्रत्याख्यन्तान्नपि धर्मराजा निर्वाणताज्ञो विहितान् मुरारे नैदेशिकार्यस्य वशे जनोऽयम्। श्रीराजभाचा निशान्यदेवा स्वपथोपवर्णितम् प्रत्याहकिन्तान्नपि धन्वराजा निवामतज्ञो नैदेशिकार्यस्य वशे जनार्यम्। Sriraj Uvacha, the king said, Nishamya, after hearing Deva, Lord Yamaraj, Subhata, of his own servants, Upavarnitam, of the statements, Pratyaha, replied, Kim, what, Tan, unto them, Api, also, Narmarajaha, Yamaraj, the superintendent of death, and the judge of religious and irreligious activities. Devam, thus, Hata Agya, whose order was foiled, Vihitan, who were defeated, Murarer Naidishe Kai Chikai, by the order carriers of Murari, Krishna, Yasya, of whom, Vashe, under the subjugation, Janayam, all the people of the world. Translation, King Parikshit said, O my Lord, O Shukadev Goswami, Yamaraj is the controller of all living entities in terms of their religious and irreligious activities, but his order had been foiled. When his servants, the Yamadutas, informed him of their defeat by the Vishnudutas, who had stopped them from arresting Ajamil, what did he reply? The report Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that although the statements of the Yamadutas were fully upheld by Vedic principles, the statements of the Vishnudutas were triumphant. This was confirmed by Yamaraj himself. So the Yamadutas had in mind that their only authority was Yamaraj. And this was their mindset. So they were very surprised and disappointed to hear that, one, there is another authority besides Yamaraj during this whole incident. Two, that this other authority seems to be more powerful than Yamaraj because, you know, Ramaraj's orders was foiled. And three, that these two authorities, they disagree with each other, apparently so. So this is creating a little dilemma for the Yamadutas, and we're going to hear about this topic, I guess, when authorities disagree. So this, or at least apparently so. So this is the topic which will probably be discussed throughout these verses. So I'll just read the next one. Text 2. Yamasya devasya nadandabhanga chutas chanarse shutapur vasit etan mune vishchati lokasang shayam nahi tvaranya iti me vinishchitam. Translation, O great sage, never before has it been heard anywhere that an order from Yamaraj has been baffled. Therefore, I think that people will have doubts about this that no one but you can eradicate. Since that is my firm conviction, kindly explain the reasons for these events. So, that's understandable. Like if you're working for a boss or something and they tell you to do something, and someone else comes and prevents you from doing that thing, it's confusing. Like if you're working for a moving company or something, and you're moving stuff out of a building to somewhere else. So you have a big moving truck, you park it in front of the building, your boss tells you park the truck here and then unload everything from the house into the truck. And then when you go bring the stuff from the building to the truck, you find that your truck is being towed away by traffic enforcement officers or something. So then you might question the authority of your boss. Like, hey, you told me to park here, and now I'm being prevented from doing what you told me to do. You might question the authority of your boss in this case. So this is perhaps what the Yamaraj or the Yamadutas are thinking. Okay, so we'll go on to the next. There's no purport to that one, so we'll go on to text 3. Sri Shuku Vacha. Okay. Bhagavat Purushai Rajan. Yamya Pratihato Dhyama. Patim Vigyapayam Asur. Yamam samyamani patim. Translation, Sri Shukadeva Goswami replied, my dear king, when the order carriers of Yamaraj were baffled and defeated by the order carriers of Vishnu, they approached their master, the controller of Saint Samyamani Puri and master of sinful persons, to tell him of this incident. Again, there's no purport to this text. So this is good, you know. If there is a seeming disagreement among authorities, the Yamaraj are giving an example, or the Yamadutas are giving an example of how one could deal with that. They can go and approach the authority directly, say, "Hey, we got this contradictory order going on here." So they approach their authority and inquire about it to get clarification. That's the much better approach. It's much better to do that than just kind of harbor ill feelings toward your authorities or something, or harbor doubts. That's bad. That's not good for your spiritual life. So there's this one story of this king who made a rule. He made a rule that there should be no hunting in this particular forest, no particular forest in his kingdom, no hunting in this forest. So one day there was this hunter who wanted to go hunt in that forest. He knew that this was the rule, but he wanted to do it anyway. He thought he can get away with it. So he went to go to this forest and he was hunting the animals. And right after he shot like a fox or something, the hunter noticed that somebody was coming in the forest. So the hunter was a little nervous because he knows he shouldn't be hunting in the forest, but yet somebody's coming and they might catch him. And it turned out that this somebody was the king who made the rule. So what the hunter did was he took the fox that he just shot and he tried to hide it underneath his shirt. to try to like hide the fact that he was hunting. So then the king came and said, "Oh, hi, how are you doing?" And good, good. It's a great day, isn't it? I'm not hunting or anything, you know. So, you know, anyway, so they just had to exchange pleasantries for some time. And then while they were exchanging pleasantries, what happened was the blood started coming from underneath the shirt of the hunter. And it turns out that the fox that the hunter was hiding wasn't actually dead. The fox was very much alive, and it wasn't the fox's blood that was running down the shirt of the hunter. It was the hunter's blood, because the fox was tearing away at the gut of the hunter. So anyway, the story is there to help to teach us that we shouldn't harbor doubts, really, or we shouldn't harbor ill feelings, because what they do is they just eat us away. It's better to just, you know, hey, here's how I'm feeling, here are my doubts, just put it on the table. Because now, when you put it out, now the enemy is exposed. You can deal with it. But if you just harbor it, it leads to degradation. So that's text 3. We'll go on to text 4. Yeah.
To this point, really a nice, very important point in our devotional service. But in spite of knowing the
principle, can you turn down the volume on this mic and probably that mic too?
What number is it?
Well,
just turn down the master.
Yeah, turn down the master volume.
Master volume on the right hand side. Master volume is bottom right corner.
Okay, Hare Krishna. All right, I think that's a little better.
Okay, good. Thank you. So, in spite of knowing all the benefits of being open-hearted and revealing our doubts and concerns to our authorities, we still find that that's not what happens. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about why, even though we know that it's much better to just be honest and straightforward, why does that not happen as much?
Could be because we don't have faith in our authorities. You know, we don't think that if I express my doubts and concerns to my authorities, they'll be able to help me at all. That's maybe one reason why people might not openly reveal their doubts. They might be fearful of the consequences if they reveal their doubts. They might think, oh wow, what will my authorities think of me, perhaps? If I reveal my doubt, especially if it's like a doubt about our own ability to practice Krishna consciousness, our own shortcomings or something, we might not want to reveal that to authorities because we might think that the authorities will think less of us because, oh, now they know our real situation. Although they probably knew all along. It's not like you're hiding anything. It's just, just general reasons like that, I guess. Those are some reasons I would think that devotees might have. Is there any other reasons people can think of that reason why people might be hesitant to reveal their doubts or short or ill feelings?
Hare Krishna. I mean, they may have never experienced what unconditional love is.
Mm, yeah.
Anyways, I'm from, you know, systemic psychology background.
Mm.
So it goes back to how, you know, I mean, how the person's parents might have dealt with them.
Mm.
For example, I can speak for myself. You know, when I was very young, I did, you know, I would do many mischiefs, but I would always hide from my parents. I would never tell them. But my son now, Gaur Govinda, I mean, so far at least, if he does something, he's the first person to come and tell us that I've done something wrong. You know, I've done something, basically. So these impressions, you know, that, you know, one carries from early on, one has a tendency to bring them also into the realms of devotional service.
Mm.
Although there is the person that is in front of us you know, the Vaishnava. So we might be projecting our experiences from our, you know, earlier life onto them. So that could be also, that happens a lot besides other things.
Mm. Nice, thanks for sharing.
Duke? Hare Krishna.
So I've been thinking a lot about how personally, and also I observe others. Mostly others means like outside of the community of devotees, but motivated by political considerations like my group and their group and friends and enemies and things like that. So I was just thinking this topic also, not revealing one's mind to one's authority could be out of like almost like a political thing, like, well, I don't know if they're actually, like, it's already been mentioned, but like my well-wisher, or they're on my team, you know, maybe they're against me, or they don't fully understand me, or they're trying to lord over me in some way, and they don't actually have my best interest in mind. These various doubts that are valid in the material world, but then, you know, Krishna is our topmost well-wisher, and anyone who's representing him is also our topmost well-wisher. And like Jagannatha Prabhu was saying, it's unconditional love. It's not that they want to push us in any particular direction, but just serve in whatever way Krishna allows so that we can progress.
Thanks. Well, there are some reasons. Right, it can be very personal and specific to each person. Some are general, but that's what Jagannatha was saying. Okay. Anything else in this verse? Okay, we'll move on to text 4. Yamaduto chuhu kati santiha shastaro jiva lokasya vaibhava trivedham kurvata karma phala bhivyakti hetava. Translation, the Yamaduta said, our dear Lord, how many controllers or rulers are there in this material world? How many causes are responsible for manifesting the various results of activities performed under the three modes of material nature, sattva-gun, rajagun, and tamagun? It's interesting, they just went right to the question. They didn't say, oh, my dear Yamaraj, you know, they didn't do the pleasantries which we hear mostly when speaking to an authority. They just went right. Well, I guess they said, our dear Lord. How many controllers are there? Anyway, purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that the Yamadutas, the order carriers of Yamaraj, were so disappointed that they asked their master, almost in great anger, whether there were many masters other than him. Furthermore, because the Yamadutas had been defeated and their master could not protect them, they were inclined to say that there was no need to serve such a master. If a servant cannot carry out the orders of his master without being defeated, what is the use of serving such a powerless master? So this is what the Yamadutas were thinking, but this doesn't mean that if we are given like an instruction from our spiritual master and we fail to carry out the instruction, we should give up our spiritual master. Because what do you mean? I wasn't able to do it. And it's blame others. It's my spiritual master's fault that I wasn't able to follow this instruction. Rather, devotee thinks it's my own nonsense or my own. It's my fault that I wasn't able to follow the instruction, not my spiritual master's. But here, the Yamadutas are kind of in a blaming mentality. You know, they're not the most spiritually enlightened personalities, the Yamadutas. One, we can see that they got angry when somebody came and stopped them from doing their job, they got really angry and disappointed. So, and then later it's said that, and they really wanted revenge, I guess, against the Vishnu Dutas. Later it's said that when they went to Yamaraj, they were hoping that Yamaraj was going to punish the Vishnu Dutas for having stopped them from doing their job. And if Yamaraj wasn't able to do that, they were going to commit suicide. So this is the mentality of the Yamadutas. So not the most, perhaps, enlightened mentality. Also, they weren't able to discriminate properly. They didn't really understand Bhagavad Dharma. They only were thinking of Trigunya Dharma. And, you know, they kind of had like their blinders on. You know, they got certain injunctions or orders from Yamaraj, and they didn't really know how to discriminate properly, so they just followed those orders and looked straight ahead and only did that without considering things in a more, in a broader way. So, and then the other thing, too, that will help us understand the position of the Yamadutas was that it seems like they don't chant the holy names of the Lord. Because later we'll see that when the Yamadutas were telling Yamaraj about what happened, Yamaraj was excited that, wow, the Yamadutas, they're chanting the name of Narayan. This hasn't happened before. This is amazing. You know, that's what Vaishnavas think when they hear especially someone new chanting the name of God. It's like, makes the devotees happy. Like yesterday, you're on Harinam or something, and a whole high school class is chanting the holy names, and I'm sure the devotees are ecstatic to see that, because, wow, how many sinful reactions were just destroyed in that one Harinam. Perhaps lifetimes of, you know, because there's probably a lot of Namabhas chanting going on, because they had no idea what the heck was going on. They just thought, oh, party, all right. So, anyway. So that's kind of like the positions of the Yamadutas. So it goes Vishnu in terms of like order of authority, I guess. Vishnu, God being like supreme, and then the Vishnu Dutas are kind of being representatives of Vishnu and almost as good as and practically as powerful as Vishnu, and as being worshipped by the demigods, the Vishnu Dutas are kind of like next. Then Yamaraj, you know, then the Yamadutas. So that's kind of how it goes here. Okay, I think we'll go on to the next text also. The first 10 verses kind of deal with the questions that the Yamadutas put forward to Yamaraj. So this is a nice little section, and it's not so big, so maybe we can finish that. Yeah, Sean?
In the introduction, about halfway into the introduction of the chapter, there was a sentence that stated something like, we need our faculties to understand the eminence of the Supreme. That's the idea I got out of it. Could you go back to that part of
this purport of this verse?
No, the first part of the introduction. It was a question in my mind about...
Introduction.
Yeah, about halfway through, something about senses being used to understand...
With material senses, no one can understand. No one can attain enlightenment about him.
Could you read that, please, a little bit clearly? I'm sorry.
With material senses, no one can attain enlightenment about the Lord. Is that what you're referring to? Is that clear? Clear that up? Okay, all right. So we'll go on to text 5. Yadie syor bahavo loke. Shastaro dandadharinaha kasya syatam navakasya mrityuscha mrittameva. In translation, if in this universe there are many rulers and justices who disagree about punishment and reward, their contradictory actions will neutralize each other, and no one will be punished or rewarded. Otherwise, if their contradictory acts fail to neutralize each other, everyone will have to be both punished and rewarded. Interesting. It's an interesting verse. Purport, because the Yamadutas had been unsuccessful in carrying out the order of Yamaraj, they doubted whether Yamaraj actually had the power to punish the sinful. Although they had gone to arrest Ajamil, following Yamaraj's order, they found themselves unsuccessful because of the order of some higher authority. Therefore, they were unsure of whether there were many authorities or only one. If there were many authorities who gave different judgments, which could be contradictory, a person might be wrongly punished or wrongly awarded, or he might be neither punished nor rewarded. According to our experience in the material world, a person punished in one court may appeal to another. Thus, the same man may be either punished or rewarded according to different judgments. However, in the law of nature or the court of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there cannot be such contradictory judgments. The judges and their judgments must be perfect and free from contradictions. Actually, the position of Yamaraj was very awkward in the case of Ajamil, because the Yamadutas were right in attempting to arrest Ajamil, but the Vishnudutas had baffled them. Although Yamaraj, under these circumstances, was accused by both the Vishnudutas and the Yamadutas, he is perfect in administering justice, because he is empowered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, he will explain what his real position is and how everyone is controlled by the Supreme Controller, the Personality of Godhead. So, these are interesting points. Especially in the modern context, it seems like there's no absolute authority or there's no agreement on what is just, what is unjust, what are moral standards. It's completely all relative and so much disagreement going on. In the Vedic system, there is an absolute authority, especially when it comes to things like punishment and reward. If you read like the Manu Samhita, there's many clear guidelines to say what is okay and what is not okay. For example, if someone commits child abuse or something, the Manu Samhita says that part of the body of that person should be cut off, and they're forced to walk toward the sun until they die. So today we might think that sounds like cruel and unusual punishment and pretty extreme. But, you know, the Vedas, capital punishment in general is kind of a touchy subject nowadays. But in the Vedas, it was actually a good thing because, one, the criminal's karma is getting released, getting freed because, you know, they're getting a reaction for their deeds. And two, the citizens don't have to deal with this criminal anymore because he's gone. For example, so in one sense, capital punishment is there in the Vedic system. But now, because nobody can agree on what's just or what's moral and what's immoral, the governments aren't able to. They keep changing their rules and their laws, because they're not in agreement about what's right and what's wrong. And then we have so many different kinds of governments nowadays. We have governments run by all kinds of governments. Governments run by the Shudras, run by the Vaishyas, run by the Kshatriyas, and run by the Brahmanas. So, like, communism is a good example of government run by the Shudras. Because it's said that, you know, the idea there is that the laborers, they would revolt. And they would take charge of the government, and their main ideal is equal salary for everybody. Of course, this doesn't really work so well, because people don't get the motivation to do anything. They become lazy because they just try to sneak by with just the littlest amount of work, and they'll get their salary no matter what. So this is not the best system of government. And you have like the government by the Vaishyas, which is kind of can be compared to like modern democracy. You know, although we might vote for our leaders and we might have like some say in what goes on, really democracy is run by the rich. because it's the rich that, you know, can say who's going to become elected, how much they're going to be advertised, and it's really, and that's kind of how democracy works now. If you have a lot of money, then you can win votes and get positions, and so it's like the vaishyas who are kind of in charge of the government. And this isn't the best for the people in general, because people are being exploited for the financial gains of the vaishyas. So that's kind of how democracy works. And, you know, the leaders are kind of in cahoots with the business barons. And anyway, it's kind of how that's working now. And then there's, like, if kshatriyas are ruling, you know, like, let's say a warlord comes, like a fighting guy, he comes and he, like, takes over an area, and he becomes, like, a monarch of an area. That doesn't work so well also, because such leaders like that, they tend to make brash decisions, and you know, they're not really receiving guidance from, that more intelligent, you know, the heads of society. So they just kind of make brash decisions, and sometimes it can lead to violent conflicts between groups of people and things like that. And then you have government run by the brahmanas. This is sometimes called a theocracy, where the brahmanas are the heads of state. And we see this in places like Iran, where the Muslim religious leaders, like called the mullahs, they're in charge of the country, and they make the decisions, they handle the money, they do things. And this doesn't work so well also, because that's not really what the religious leaders are supposed to do. They're not supposed to be involved with these kind of politics and stuff. So anyway, so all of these kind of systems of government, they don't really work so well. Yeah, I was gonna get to that point. Yes.
Hare Krishna. I understand the point you're trying to make, but I mean, to say that mullah society in Iran is a Brahmin society.
Okay, it's just an example. If
I don't see how that example works at all.
All right.
Because in Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada clearly states that
modern government
is run by less than Shudras.
Okay.
I'm sure you can find the supporting quote, but I understand the point you're trying to make, but I think we know about Varna and Ashram in that sense.
I'm not going to argue whether the government in Iran is a...
I don't think it's the right way to make the point.
It is an example to demonstrate a point. It's not. I'm not arguing whether the example. Okay, whatever. Did you have something to say, Luke?
That died on the hot seat up there. On the topic of people disagreeing about what is just and what is moral and everything. I was in New York, and I had the chance to speak with a few of friends that I had from college. And a really popular conception amongst the young people today, it's even more degraded than arguing about whether this is just or that's just, or this is moral or that's moral. Many, many people subscribe to the idea that there is no justice, there is no morality.
It's becoming more popular.
It's completely... random universe, and everything is, it's like the perverted reflection of the absolute conception. It's like the Paramahansa, he sees everything as Krishna, so everything's all good. And then the totally, you know, morally bankrupt and idiotic person, he sees everything's on an equal platform, because anyway, it's all meaningless, and for my sense gratification, you know. So anyway, and it's just really frustrating and tragic also that's becoming more and more the common conception.
Yeah, my whole family's like that, so that's how I grew up, and so a lot of people are growing up nowadays is that, you know, morality is just relative. In order to make the society function, that's kind of like the whole purpose of morality nowadays. Like my brother, I don't know if I, my brother, for example, we were all raised Catholic, but none of us were really following so strictly. So anyway, my brother grew up and he was he has kids now. So I guess he was debating. He wasn't sure if he should get his kids baptized or not in the Catholic faith because he didn't really agree with it so much. But he ended up baptizing his kids, although he didn't agree with the religion. And he said that, okay, I'm doing this just so that I can give my kids a moral compass. You know, I don't agree with the philosophy or the religion or anything, but I like the religion in the sense that it can give you a moral compass. It can help you become a good person. Other than that, I'm not really interested in religion. So that's kind of common nowadays. And then if you're already a good person, there's no need for religion. So you just, right. So that is there. So. Anyway, so is there any other thing, any other point you want to bring up on that topic?
If that's all right. On the topic of the capital punishment, I think a really, like the way it really benefited the Vedic society is that then people would see this is actually the reaction.
Right, you don't have so many child abuse cases if they see one person get their body cut off and they have to walk until they die.
Right, then who would do, much less people would do it, you know?
Right.
But it's not like the government is, you know, going overboard, one might say, because that's actually the laws of nature work like that. It's very strict, you know? You violate this person's... you commit violence to this person, then you also have to undergo that violence. Otherwise, how do we learn compassion? So it's not like the government, it's not excessive in any way. That's just the law of nature. And when the government creates a legal system that corresponds to the laws of nature, then people can see how stringently the laws of nature are working, and then they become a little bit sobered up, you know?
That's right. That's a good point. Thanks. What would you say?
You can ask questions.
Yeah, 1 second, I'll give you.
I'm a TV and radio journalist and film actor, singer, dancer. Through a long series of events that had nothing to do with my personal cause and effect, I ended up cleaning up after other people's messes, so to speak. And in the process, my fingertip was severed. I nearly died because I was beaten nearly to death by two corrupt Rogers Park police officers. The trail of cause and effect, if you're not energetically where you're supposed to be in terms of connecting with following cosmic law and God's, you know, order, in other words, doing... being kind to yourself and kind to others. If you don't follow that cosmic order, then ultimately everyone pays and everyone suffers because we are connected. However, we're individualized presences. So my question to you is, what do you think is the real challenge in terms of having the laws of man meet with God's laws? What do you think is the real challenge?
Well, so this is going to get to my next point, which I was kind of going to transition into, was what is the ideal government? You know, because I just talked about four kinds of government, which may not be the most ideal. But how government should be run is that it should be based on Shastra, based on the laws of God. That's how things should work. And it should be controlled by the Kshatriyas, the administrative class of, you know, society. And it should, and those Kshatriyas should be advised by the Brahmanas. So that's how society should work. So the Brahmanas are supposed to understand Shastra and how to apply it in society, and the Kshatriyas are supposed to actually administer the advice of the brahmanas. So as far as getting to there, yeah, it's a big challenge nowadays, because right now we're run by man-made laws, and we're not even considering the laws of God. We have the separation of church and state, and if you try to introduce God into like public policy, it creates a huge uproar, at least in today's world. So it's a big challenge, and you know, so at least we can start with our own society and how our own society functions. So and ideally the Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas, they should be kind of, they wouldn't perform the functions of the other Varna, I guess. So the Kshatriya would simply be engaged in administration and management, and then the Brahmanas would simply be engaged in, you know, study, advisory, brahminical activities. But the problem sometimes that we face in our society is that we have devotees that do both, that do both administration and brahminical work, you know, simultaneously. And sometimes this can create conflicts, because there's a conflict of interest there. For example, like if somebody comes into the temple and is looking for spiritual advice, so they go to the temple president, and the temple president is supposed to be like a managerial position in the way our society is set up. It's like a managerial position. So somebody comes in, they're looking for spiritual advice, they go to the temple president, and they say, I need some advice for my life. And then the temple president has a kind of has a certain way of thinking, because he's managing the whole temple. So he might be thinking, oh, we need some donations, we need people to do RT, you know. So he's thinking already like what the temple needs. So if somebody comes and is looking for spiritual advice, there's a conflict of interest there, because you know the temple president might be thinking, okay, oh, this person might be good for this particular need in our temple. So, and it's not always so easy to separate. You perform both functions. You know, Prabhupada was able to do it because he is totally transcendental, and you know. But as far as I know, a lot of the leaders in our society today who wear multiple hats, like the managerial hat, even the guru hat or whatever, they express like this. Sometimes it's not easy to wear multiple hats, and it's certainly confusing for the subordinate, like the student, because if you're going up to somebody and you have to ask like what hat are you wearing today? Are you my advisor, my mentor, or my boss? Like, how am I supposed to deal with you if I know that you're dealing with, if you can wear multiple hats? So sometimes it can be confusing if there's like this mix of kind of roles in society. Like if you were working at an IT company or something, and your boss also happened to be your guru, it'd be a little weird, because you know your boss is telling you to do something for your work, but he's also your spiritual master. So that even more. So yes, Luke.
Hang on that topic, if that's all right. It's very short. Just to kind of put it in perspective. We understand that the administrator, his service requires him to be concerned about his reputation and be conscious of that. How the praja, the people who are looking up to him and following him, perceive him. It's very important to be able to lead others. You have to be conscious of your reputation. Whereas the brahmana, his primary duty is to speak the truth without any consideration of what kind of reputation that might, you know, give him.
Right.
So right there, it's a very clear incompatibility, you know, that if you try to do both, then it will be like doing one much less than perfect and doing the other much less than perfect, rather than the Vedic paradigm where there's a specific duty, a specific person assigned to this one and a person assigned to that one.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. So therefore, we need purely Kshatriyas and purely Brahmanas. And as far as possible, we can try to... I mean, we're kind of, you know, our situation right now might not be so ideal,
right,
and we're working towards the ideal, but at least that's what we should strive for, because that's how the system should work. Jagannanda Prabhu.
Prabhupada writes, continuing to answer her question, Prabhupada writes in many of his purports that the ideal system is monarchy. But monarchy where the person that is leading the state is a Vaishnava. And we hear, like even during Lord Ramachandra's times and even during Yudhishthira Maharaj's times, so even in the system of monarchy, there are hierarchies. There is a king and there is an emperor. I'm sure we've heard, you know, history, Roman Empire, and there's the emperor. And so, but the same concept works. And these emperors, like Yudhishthira Maharaj or Lord Ramachandra, they would send, like they would not even, you know, conquer others by force. You know. So the king would send basically a horse, the emperor. And the different kings that are ruling different parts of the world or the country, so the emperor is inviting, actually. So it's not a, you know, challenge, it's inviting to get the protection that the emperor is able to provide. And so the kings, when they know that, wow, this is a, you know, a God-centered person, God-centered king, so they are happily, you know, they surrender to the emperor. So that's ideal. Prabhupada would sometimes, you know, call democracy, you know, democracy. Especially when God is not at the center, then you know, there are so many opinions of so many people.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you're saying, you know, actually some of these things, they become you know, the horses on which these people ride to get to the government. You know, like what is, you know, somebody's policy or views on abortion, and they write that ticket and they actually come into power, and then the next person, you know he does something else, and the other, yeah. So in summarily, if God is not at the center, then it's just a matter of time, tomorrow, day after, where things are going to degrade. I was hearing a lecture this morning, like this whole issue about, Maharaj was saying, he was giving a class in India, and I think, wait a minute, you know, wait a while, and these same issues that are, you know, challenges of the Western world now, they'll become the challenges of, you know, India, because, you know, Krishna, God, continues to move away and away from the center. So that's a solution. Prabhupada says, the only thing that is lacking in this world is Krishna consciousness. And when that is there, then things fall into place. And as you're saying, even the Brahmana, so he has to be guided by a Vaishnava. So everybody has a spiritual master. And so ideally we want a leader to be a transcendentalist, not even one who is in the mode of goodness, so to speak. You know, because there is a mode of goodness sometimes is overcome by passion and ignorance. So we want, you know, transcendentalists. And even amongst Vaishnavas, there are categories. You know, there is, you know, Parivrajakacharya, there is Kutichaka, Bahudaka, Parivrajakacharya, and there is Paramahamsa. So there, everybody is, you know, has an authority, basically. Yeah, so like that. So when there is this, the transparent line of authority, going back to Krishna, then it's a, you know, Vaikuntha state. It's a Rama Rajya. That's what Prabhupada said, basically. Anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting, because it is kind of like a topic being discussed, I guess, within ISKCON, is like the whole parallel lines of authority thing. So for those of you who are not aware of this issue, then in ISKCON we have a very clear managerial authority. You know, after when Prabhupada was on the planet, he was like the authority. Is like a, that he was the main authority for everything. And then he appointed it when he left the GBC body to be the next authority. So any conflicts or issues that arise within ISKCON, ultimately they decide what happens and they can resolve those issues. And then, you know, then individual GBCs are next in particular areas, and then zonal secretaries, regional secretaries, temple presidents, congregational leaders, temple commanders, all the way down to the pot washer. So there's a very clear line of authority, managerial authority within ISKCON. And this is how most companies run, with a very clear line of authority. And then with that clear line of authority, things can get done, conflicts get resolved, it works. Now within ISKCON, there's like this issue, because along with that managerial authority, there's also a what they call the spiritual line of authority, which Jagannatha Prabhu was saying is coming directly from Krishna. So there's Krishna who's, you know, speaking to Lord Brahma, Brahma to Narada, to Vyas, all the way to Srila Prabhupada and to our spiritual masters. And then it's said that the spiritual masters, that we're supposed to follow and obey the orders of the spiritual master, because it's like the spiritual line of authority. And therefore, spiritual masters, they take kind of authority over their disciples. And sometimes there's a conflict between the two. and this has happened in our society, and this is clearly an issue, because we have two lines of authority, and when you have two authorities, sometimes it's difficult to know how to resolve conflicts.
Authorities can resolve it amongst themselves.
That's ideal, yes.
Very well.
Yeah, like, that's easy.
Like a parent, you know, do I need to choose my mother or my father?
Yeah.
it's a hard one.
Right, so that should always be the first course of action. And usually that's the case most of the time, is that, you know, if there's any disagreement, the authorities, they work it out and come up with something which is ultimately for the best. I guess, so it's a little, maybe it's not totally, it might be a little controversial, and it's a little, they're still working on it, but I think that in cases where there is no a total agreement among the two different authorities, the way ISKCON is dealing with it, at least in that paper, it kind of gives deference to the managerial authority. This is the way the ISKCON has decided to resolve this issue, this particular issue. It's already 8:30, but I was going to try to explain this whole dynamic. People don't mind. It's going to take another 5 minutes or 10 minutes. So the way this, okay, the idea is that first of all, according to this paper, there's like this oneness and difference amongst lines of authority, like the managerial authority and spiritual authority. So Prabhupada said that managerial activities is also spiritual activities, because it's Krishna's establishment. We're doing this for Krishna. That's one point. Another point is that Prabhupada said that generally the managers will take spiritual authority over those devotees under his care. So he'll kind of act as both spiritual authority and managerial authority, it seems, from these quotes that this paper is using to say how they're different and simultaneously the same and different, but they are also different. So there's a clear, you know, because there's issues that arise. Like, let's say a spiritual master comes to a particular area and over in which he has influence, but he's not like the managerial authority of a particular region. He might go up to one of his disciples or something and say, oh, you don't need to follow the temple president because I'm your spiritual master. So instead of giving all the, when you go out in Sankirtan and giving all the money to the temple president, you give it to me. This is a conflict, because a spiritual master is, in one sense, interfering with the although you might even be like a competent and responsible manager, he's interfering with the management of that particular area. So this creates a conflict there. And also it can happen on the other side too. On the other hand, the manager, they might not be providing adequate spiritual care to the devotees in his area. So the spiritual master, you know, they would feel the impulse to intervene here because, oh, you're not taking care of my disciples or my people who have taken shelter of me. So I'm going to intervene and give them the proper spiritual care. So there's conflicts on both sides with the managerial authority and the spiritual authority. So the way ISKCON resolves it is by giving deference to the managerial authority. And that the spiritual master should work with the managerial authority and ultimately ask for permission from the managerial authority before suggesting any changes in service or sangha for his disciple. He should first check in with the temple president or whoever, and then tell his disciple or whatever that something can change. And then the spiritual master is also supposed to teach the disciple to cooperate with the managerial authority in that particular region where he's at. So this is how ISKCON has chosen to, harmonize these two lines of authorities right now. Again, it's still under discussion. It's interesting if you compare the way ISKCON work, if you compare ISKCON and the way ISKCON operates to the way the universe and the way the universe operates, particularly in regard to this story here with Ajamil and the Yamadutas and Yamaraj and Vishnudutas. So in this story, there's a very clear managerial authority. It's Yamaraj. You know, he's like the managerial authority of the whole universe. Whatever he says goes. And dealing with all matters of justice and he's the managerial authority. And then in the story, you can also kind of consider like the Vishnudutas as like the spiritual authority, because they're representatives of Vishnu. They're just as good as Vishnu, and they're like the spiritual authority in this particular story. So in one sense, there's some comparisons between ISKCON and the universe. You know, like both are meant to help living entities come nearer to Krishna. Ultimately, that's the whole purpose of the universe, to like, you know, train up living entities how to become closer to Krishna. That's what ISKCON's function is also. So it's interesting how lines of authority work in the universe, not considering ISKCON, but how it works in the universe. In the universe, it's, according to this story, the spiritual line of authority is the ultimate authority, you know, and the material authority is subordinate to the spiritual authority. In ISKCON, it's a little different, seemingly. It seems that the managerial authority is kind of the ultimate authority, and then the spiritual authority is kind of subordinate to and has to ask for permission from the managerial authority. But in this case, the Vishnudutas, they just came in. You know, they saw something not going on properly. They didn't go consult with Yamaraj about, you know, hey, Yamaraj, there's this issue going on here with this person. You know, I have spiritual authority over him because he chants my name, but you have managerial authority over him because he did so many sinful activities. I just wanted to check with you to see if it's okay if I prevent your servants from taking him down to hell. It's not really said like that in the scriptures anywhere. Rather, the Vishnudutas, they just came in. you know, they were the authority, and they did their thing, and ultimately Yamaraj had to say, yes, you are the authority, you are the spiritual authority, you are the ultimate authority in matters. And it wasn't an issue ultimately. So like that's how that can be realized, you know, like kind of harmonized, I guess. But it's clear that the ultimate authority is the spiritual authority, though, in the universe. Whereas in this kind, it's a little unclear. It seems like the managerial authority is the ultimate. So it's food for thought. I had a lot more I wanted to say about this topic.
Okay. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Class was so nice. The one thing I wanted to say that in the last canto when we heard about Bali Maharaj, in that it was the point was elucidated very nicely that even if the authority figure or the king figure has made some instruction that is not apropos or is not being accepted, Praja still has to accept that as the order of the king, and that's the duty of the Praja to accept that. And so, I mean, we're very lucky because we have like Nityananda Pran as temple president, you know, although he's away for personal matter currently. But I've seen him sitting many times and speaking nicely, you know, managerial stuff and spiritual stuff. And so in that sense, it's very good. But earlier in your class, it was really good when you were saying the point I wanted to make, and I wasn't sure if I would be able to make a relevant tie-in. That's why I waited till now, that by accepting the order of the authority, that itself is a type of self-chastisement. No, in the previous canto, it was the point was elucidated that the Praja has to accept the order of the king, even if the king, I don't want to say unrighteous, but the essence of it was that... Yes, yeah, it was a long canto. We can review that later.
Yes.
Why? No, let me just make the point that I'm making. Then we can explain that later. The point I'm making is that if... you got me totally off thought now. What you had said earlier...
Can you...
No, but there was also a point in the previous canto that even if the king, the leader, is not leading correctly, the Praja is still duty-bound to the king. That's the only point I'm making. And so what I want, the relevant tie-in that I'm trying to say is that by following the authority, regardless of whether we have the knowledge to accept it or if we know the total picture or not, we have to accept it. That is a form of maybe self-chastisement is the wrong thing, but that itself is a corrective and preventive action in our spiritual life. By following the order, although we may not understand it at that time, if we follow that, that will help us evolve our spirituality into a more functional and just spirituality. That's my point only. No, even I'm not going that far. I'm saying that we have to simply submission. This Balram Prabhu mentioned this in a home program. Okay. Submission is the first thing. If we submit, naturally we will be corrected
activities. Can you give
the microphone? Hare Krishna.
Is it right if I just very quickly?
Quickly.
So my concern, which I feel is an important one to at least bring into the discussion, is that the example you mentioned, actually, the real lesson to be learned is Bali Maharaj, his Gurudev was Shukracharya. And Shukracharya was saying, no, do not give any of your kingdom to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And in that case, and that's right, so I'm saying in that case, the authority was giving an improper instruction, and it did not... agree with the instruction and desire of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Bali Maharaj set the perfect example by ignoring his authority and accepting the supreme authority of the Supreme Person.
Yes.
So there is various considerations of, you know, mundane authority and mundane dharma, but the highest dharma is to act according to the instruction and desire of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And real authority is to repeat the words and instructions of the Supreme Person. And wherever a person is not repeating the words and instructions of Krishna, then he's not actually an authority, and we are not bound to follow such a person.
However. Okay, no, not however. Okay, not however. Okay, we're done. Hey, could you please stop talking? Okay.
No, he's Guru Abbas. He's Guru right. Chaya. He's not Guru.
Okay, I mean, I had a lot more I wanted to say, but apparently everybody wants to say something. Yes, I'm just going to make quick little points to finish up. So we do see sometimes that there are disagreements between authorities, like the case of Shukracharya, Vamana. And they're different, you know, seeming conflicts, different authorities having different opinions. And I would like to say that in some senses, this can actually, because the way the Yamadutas dealt with this, they got upset and angry. This was their reaction to this conflict. I would like to suggest that our reaction can be different. Our reaction can be, it can actually bring us like solace, and it can actually be an okay thing that there's perhaps disagreements between different authorities for different reasons. One reason is that it makes us think, you know, that's one thing, because oftentimes we just get into this, you know, we put on the blinders and we go ahead and we don't look left or right and we're just blindly following. But if when authorities seem to contradict each other, it seems like, okay, now we have to think. We have to really consider more than just what we were considering. And by doing that exercise, we can make a spiritual advancement. That's perhaps one good way that we can see conflicts among authority. Also, at least in terms of ISKCON and ISKCON's history, we haven't figured everything out yet. And, you know, Chandramali Maharaj was saying this when he was giving his seminar on Guru Tattva, that we haven't figured everything out yet. You know, especially, like, even in, like, North, having a working model of a Brahmachari ashram in North America, for example. Where do we see, like, a really good model of a Brahmachari ashram in North America or the Western world in general? We're working it out. We're trying to figure out how to do that. And we haven't figured everything out yet. Similarly with the whole, you know, the issues like a multi-guru system within ISKCON, we haven't necessarily figured everything out yet. You know, when Prabhupada was here, he was the ultimate authority. After Prabhupada departed, we had the zonal acharya system for a while. That got scrapped. That got changed. Now we're on to this current system where there's like this complex guru selection process. That's our current system, skipping a lot of details. And who's to say it's not going to change in the future, for example? So in one sense, that can give us solace in the sense that we can be a part of trying to, you know, help spread Lord Chaitanya's movement as far as possible. We can contribute. We haven't figured everything out yet, so we can contribute and try to add to that, or, you know, be a part of that movement. Another thing is that we're all individuals. We're all personalities. We all serve Krishna in a unique way, which Krishna specifically likes. So we might have disagreements about what's the best way to serve Krishna, because we have a particular way of serving Krishna. Someone else has a particular way of serving Krishna, and they're both great. So sometimes that might filter into like managerial visions, for how certain things should be done, because we have different ways that we want to serve Krishna. But disagreements are okay. But as long as you're respectful and you're not offensive or anything, disagreements are okay. Even GBCs, among all of them, they disagree with each other. You know, the GBCs are the authorities. And not every GBC, there's no unanimous votes. There's a lot of issues where there's no unanimous votes that all the GBCs agree on one particular issue. So if authorities can disagree with each other's at least managerial decisions, then it seems like there's room in there for disagreement being like an okay thing. It's not like you're a bad devotee if you disagree with the managerial structure the way it is now or something.
There are many capable leaders, then at least I feel like, wow, okay. Yeah, it feels better to have many leaders than just, you know, one. Yeah.
That's right. That's a good point, too. Yeah, so that it, instead of just having one leader authority who makes all the decisions and runs the show, it's nice to have many leaders who are cooperating with each other to help serve Lord Chaitanya's movement of spreading the Sankirtan all over the... It's nice. That's like an amazing thing. It's like an amazing thing that ISKCON's able to cooperate with, having so many different leaders, and we're still able to work together to glorify Krishna together. It's like, great. It's amazing. So we have a wonderful system now. So anyway, that's just another nice ending point, I think, that we can all take home with us. So, okay, we'll end here. It's already 8:50. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.